Now, this leads me to another question that I had recently. It came from, I hope I'm getting this right, Sahil Mopkar. And he said, if you look at most improved player voting for the last 20, 25 years or whatever, you basically see no big men. And I'm wondering, you know, I think the obvious things have to do with, like, valuing scorers who have a huge scoring jump that's going to get you on the most improved player radar. But have you had a different, you know, when you came in and started covering the game in the mid and late 2000s, did you say, wait a second, like, why don't we have a guy, I don't know, maybe it's Dwight Howard when he was coming, you know, when he was ascending up the aging curve and becoming a dominant defender, he basically never had most improved player votes. And yet from 2007 to 2009, Dwight Howard maybe improved more than any other player in the league outside of LeBron James. You know, did you have a sort of perspective, or what's your take on that if we look at, like, recent great defenders who have exploded but seem to get no appreciation for it?
I think the obvious case is pretty close to the true one. They're the strongest. It's not a single, you know, it's not a single mutually exclusive thing. But scoring is easier to quantify. Scoring is easier. And the one that really bothered me in my early days covering the league was not so much that as much as it was the quote-unquote improvement, volume improvement, that was largely built on increased playing time. Because there were players who got a lot of buzz for it who all that happened was they played more. They weren't more efficient. They weren't a different player. They just played more. And that's, like, to me, that's not improvement. You know, whatever you're measuring, if all it is increased opportunity, you know, and I think there is sometimes an underrated thing that, like, taking on higher usage, let's call it usage instead of minutes per game, that actually can be difficult. Pascal Siakam is a great example here. There are various ones over the last few years. But generally speaking, it was player X played 10 minutes a game, then they played 28 minutes a game because they became a starter, and their scoring went up by 1.5. Well, duh! Like, that's what's supposed to happen.
Yeah.
And those got me really angry, and as they should. I mean, that's the way that these things work. And I think that in the overall sense, there absolutely is a part, you know, defense, not only is it harder to quantify, but sometimes those young bigs, they were already playing. And so it was an even harder thing to sometimes justify because they, you know, like Dwight, he was still getting playing time in those early years before he was getting better. And so then the points per game aren't shifting as much.
Yeah.
And it's more by watching. And, you know, especially in those days, being a national NBA fan or analyst or whatever was a lot harder.
Well,
like now with the internet, if you have it, things like Synergy, it is so much easier to keep tabs on everything, both film wise and statistically.
And I feel like you're alluding to something like 2010. Marc Gasol was not most improved player that year. A big man, he's already playing when he's younger, you know, he's getting those minutes, but from my eye, defense, offense, rounding into shape, you're becoming more of an impact player. And do you remember who won in 2010 most improved player? It's a small guard whose playing time increased.
Oh god.
Aaron Brooks.
Oh yeah. Well, and there's another big one. Nate and I have been hammering this the last couple of years. I think that it is that really good players should win most improved more often, partially because their improvement is more important. You know, like, I think there was a credible argument that Giannis should have either won or gotten second last year. That doesn't happen as much. It's kind of like, I think we're going to see this with Mike Budenholzer this year for Coach of the Year, where once you've already done the rebuilding, you don't get as much credit for how good the coaching job was.
Yeah.
And there are times when, and you know, that's the weird thing about having a platform and having some people listen to you, but obviously far from all, I'm conflicted at times with whether I want to lament that some of that nuance is lost in terms of awards. And then there's a part of me that gets more nihilist and says, well, awards don't matter. You know, Mike Budenholzer is still a really good coach, even if he doesn't win Coach of the Year this year. I actually won't have him number one anyway, as of right now. But then there's a part of me that goes, well, it's exciting to still have things that we can work on and things that conversations that are worth having. And then also remembering that there are going to be new voices and that there are going to be, we're going to have more information and there are going to be new conversations as well. So there's a part of me that just wants to change the process of it more, because then we'll be ready to have those conversations at that time.
It cuts both ways. And certainly, I mean, another challenge with some of these awards is there's a deliberate sort of ambiguity to the criteria and the voting process, where I sometimes there seems to be this inherent thing or this implicit unspoken thing where if it's your second year, you don't get as much credit for improving. To your point, if you're good and you become great, usually you don't get much credit for that unless it's scoring, unless that was the last piece that you filled in. Like Tracy McGrady had that, where he was good, he was okay, and then he became good, and I think he won Most Improved Player, and then he almost won it again because his scoring went to like, whatever, 26 points a game, another huge boost. So there seem to be these rubrics that are kind of like unspoken. But let's take one. Let's look at 2015, because that one has always been fascinating to me. 2015, Jimmy Butler wins Most Improved Player. Now, there were two other monster improvements that year that, for my money, were probably not only bigger but more important than Butler's jump in scoring. And I can't remember his minutes per game jump off the top of my head. But
it was actually zero, because Jimmy Butler basically has played a lot of minutes since the second year.
Okay.
He went from 38.7 to 38.7.
Right. Okay. So then it was like a 13 per game score to like 20 or something like that. Is that?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay. Right. So he has that jump and that wins him Most Improved Player. But for my money, man, like Rudy Gobert started to become Rudy Gobert that year. And Draymond Green came from basically what felt like nowhere to become this monster player on a nearly 70-win team. So any thoughts on that? I that's to me a classic example of sort of these biases in the perception of the game being focused on scoring, being focused on the things we can measure, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, they're both players that I was kind of close with in certain ways. I was really high on Gobert as a draft prospect, and then was thrilled at how much he improved especially as a defender. But and his offensive growth came a little bit later than that, which sometimes happens for bigs as well. Draymond is such a fascinating test case because a portion of it was pure happenstance. I mean, I think it's pretty known now that Steve Kerr was not intending to have Draymond Green as the starter on that team. But David Lee got hurt. I think he had a hamstring issue in like their second to last preseason game. And Draymond was the next man up and was better than David Lee in the first place. But Lee was established and all that kind of stuff. And there was, I think that was a Bob Vulgaris tweet from the year. I think it was the year before where these like the Warriors are a David Lee injury away from like competing, like being really good or something like that. And he was right for various reasons. But it is such a fascinating thing with Draymond in terms of the role that he was put in, and then the offense, of course, changing around. That actually, there was something else I wanted to talk about when we were talking about the roles and situations and all that, and the preconditions, was also the idea of, and Draymond's actually a prototypical example of this, of why I like to separate out offensive role instead of position, because there is this idea that gets out there of, oh, well, if you have a big that doesn't shoot, or that does shoot, then that opens the floor for somebody else who doesn't shoot. And that's true. You can do that. It does open that possibility. But it also opens up the possibility for five out. As long as there are certain boxes, like somebody who can initiate a pick and roll, somebody who can make a pass, various things, I think that's the next part of this conversation that I'm really excited about. And Draymond Green's a great example because his skill set is so unusual for someone his size.
Yeah, you and Nate are going to be stuck at some point with your positional rankings, I think.
We are.
Because of this issue, right? It's like you've got what you do on defense and the type of player you guard and, you know, what your sort of defensive skills are. And then the wide range of versatility on offense from your role versus 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And I do not envy the tasks you guys are going to have in a few years when the whole league. Have you talked about how you're going to some alternative to ranking players by 1 through 5? Positions?
We have, but I think that we'll stick with it. And you just have to decide how valuable those specific offensive things are, you know, like so Nikola Jokic versus Gobert or something like that. And there are challenges, but I think we as analysts can do that well enough. And I think the most important thing and why it'll likely stay by positions, and Nate and I have talked about it, is because you're looking for a way that can split the entire league into a reasonable number of groups. You know, I would say somewhere between four and six, four, like four, five, six, seven, maybe, that everybody is eligible once and nobody is ineligible. You know, like that sort of an idea. And that's why positions actually works pretty well. It becomes harder to like separate out, you know, like what certain players do and is this more valuable than that. But I actually love those conversations. And that's a part of why I want to keep it the way that it is because arguing about whether what James Harden does versus Klay Thompson versus some defensive, like whatever it is, like those are good conversations to have. And sometimes drawing lines in weird ways actually facilitates those thought processes.
Yeah.